I'll be the room facilitator for room 129B. And here's our speaker, Alan Hong. She will be speaking about domestic and sexual violence in the Asian Pacific community. What is the church's response? Please allow me to introduce Alan. So she is a mother of two girls, wife, and a Taiwanese Christian feminist. Alan's passion is to help those around her walk in their full personhood. Upon graduating from Fuller Theological Seminary in 2003, Alan was awarded the Parish Pulpit Fellowship. This prestigious preaching award allowed her to live abroad in London, Uganda, and Taiwan. After being exposed to the global challenges of poverty, violence, and gender bias, Alan committed to serve as a minister of gospel to those who are most marginalized in the community around her. For the past 14 years, Alan has worked at the nonprofit organization CPAF, Center for the Pacific Asian Family, building out the shelter and community programs. Currently, she serves as the director of special projects, educating and activating communities to build safe spaces for families, especially women and girls. Alan holds a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering from University of California, Los Angeles, and a Master of Divinity, Cross-Cultural Concentration from Fuller Theological Seminary. Thank you, Alan. Yeah. So let's welcome Sister Alan.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for being part of this workshop today. I heard this is a really big convention. I've never been here before, but it's such a privilege and an honor to be here. I'm glad, actually, that we have a smaller group because I know that this is a topic that can be hard to talk about. And I think particularly within churches and faith communities, I think people don't want to talk about it. It's hard to talk about. So we're going to explore that a little bit today, and I know we're on a time schedule, so I'll try to get through as much as I can. I know that this is primarily a Taiwanese and Mandarin-speaking convention, so I apologize that I'm using English. I'm actually very fluent in Taiwanese, and I could probably do this presentation in Taiwanese, but I can't do it in Mandarin. I don't speak Mandarin at all. So sorry. If I can, I will try to use a little bit of Mandarin, but I'm not fluent at all. Because we're such a small group, can I just ask people to share your name? And if you want to, you can tell us why you chose to be in this workshop. So anybody can start. We don't have to go in order, but you know that way people feel comfortable. You don't have to be nervous, like, it's almost my turn. I don't know what I'm going to say, and you're not listening to anybody else. So feel free, just if you want to, and if you don't want to introduce yourself, that's okay. I'll just give it like a minute or two.
So I'll start. My name is Amy. Currently, I'm a family ministry student at Lodo. My church is Lutheran Glory Church. And yeah, I have to be here, but I'm very thankful because I can listen to Alan's speech.
Hi, my name is Patricia. Actually, my husband took this workshop, and he is from GTI Development. I guess the reason why I just think is I live to my husband.
So, my name is Jeff, and the reason I think this topic is because just right now we are still group leader, and then we don't want to, but we hopefully not facing this kind of issue in our soul. So yeah. Maybe I just come here and listen.
Thank you.
It seems like a very important and interesting topic. We didn't get a lot of attention from myself, Jeff. So, I wanted to learn more, and maybe I can share what I learned today back to my church and talk to my church friends.
Reason to be topic is my life has been always involved with family and children.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is a topic where it's like I would see from my case to case, I might have encountered some similar or a little bit different. So, just kind of interested to see how that would be, in our church perspective.
Thank you.
My name is Julian Yepo. I actually go to, I think, UFC South Bay, Torrance. I don't actually speak any Mandarin or Chinese like that. So I was trying to select which workshop to go to, and this is one of the few that are English, so.
Thank you.
But it's still a very interesting topic, yeah. So I'm interested to find out which one.
Thank you for coming.
My name is Ted Chan. I'm with the Theologian Church. Okay. I don't know everybody across that, of course, speaking English. I think we should have a more serious workshop.
Oh.
I'm just actually the main reason why I chose this.
Oh, thank you for coming.
Another thing is I found these titles very interesting. I'm not aware of them here in the domestic and sexual violence, but I'm not aware of them in my history. So,
okay.
That's it.
Thank you.
My name is Iris Wong. I'm a licensed professional. So we have cases that have to go to the hospital. So we have a lot of work in the
hospital.
Come on in!
Come on in!
Joshua. I'm from Blessed Chinese. Because of the past of the children, I want to see how the church should respond to this council.
Okay.
This is my daughter, Priscilla.
Hi, Priscilla. Thank you for coming. Well, thank you everybody for introducing yourselves. I do apologize because I feel so limited, and I know that for many of us, our first language is not English, so if you're comfortable asking questions in your first language, please feel free to do so, and then I will look to Amy to help me understand maybe the content of the question, but that way I want everybody to use the language that they're most comfortable with. One thing before I get started in the presentation, and just a little bit of introduction about where I come from, is I want to ask how many people prefer to wait for the whole presentation to be done and then ask questions? And then how many people prefer to ask questions during the presentation? And I'll have you guys vote so that we can just go at a pace that most people feel like they want to go at. Who prefers to wait till the very end and then just ask the questions for Q&A? Who prefers to ask throughout the presentation? Sorry, I think you guys have to wait till the end because I think there are a little bit more people. So, and in the interest of time, maybe that'll be best. So if you do have questions along the way, can I ask that you just write them down and then we can do a Q&A with everybody's questions at the end, okay? All right. So as Amy said, I work for CPAF, Center for the Pacific Asian Family. It's a nonprofit organization that was founded in 1978, actually here in Los Angeles, by a Filipina-American woman by the name of Nilda Romonte. And she actually founded this organization because she was doing a needs assessment in the community. And she was asking a very hard question. She was asking the question, what would happen if an Asian woman who was an immigrant from another country, came to the United States and she was raped? What would she do? Where would she go? What resources would she have? And she looked throughout the country, throughout the community, and she found that there were no resources. If you didn't speak English, if you were here as an immigrant and you didn't know anybody, like your family is not here, they're back in China or Taiwan or Hong Kong or Singapore, how will you get that help? And she realized there's not a lot of places in which you could get help. So she founded the first 24-hour hotline, which still runs to this day, every single day of the year, not even closed on Christmas. We have a live, trained domestic violence and sexual assault counselor taking the calls. And we have a staff of over 40 people. Over 90% of our staff are Asian Pacific Islander, or they speak some sort of API language. And they're trained in responding to domestic violence and sexual assault, particularly for the Asian community. Now, you're probably thinking, why do you have to have one just for Asian community? And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the mission of CPAF is to build healthy and safe communities by addressing the root causes and the consequences of family violence and violence against women. And our vision is to hopefully include the whole API community who shares this vision and wants to work towards building healthier relationships and eradicating or ending all types of violence. To this day, just to kind of give you a little bit about our services, in addition to the 24-hour hotline, we also run 3 shelters, 1 emergency shelter, and 2 more transitional shelters that are confidential. So, you know, actually, if you work there and your spouse asks you, where's your office? If you work in the shelter, you actually can't tell them where you work. You just have to be like, you have to trust me that I'm going to work today. You cannot send flowers to me, or you cannot have lunch with me at my office. So we do run 3 confidential shelter locations, and we have a number of community programs that I'm running. We have some prevention programming in high schools. We actually have worked very closely with San Gabriel High School, as well as Inez Middle School out here in San Gabriel Valley, if you're out here. And we are also working with other community nonprofits that have youth programs to really want to address violence with youth before it becomes a domestic violence situation. I'm also representing APIGBV. So this is a national resource center that is based in San Francisco, and I am partnering with them right now on this project. And APIGBV, so Asian Pacific Institute on Gender-Based Violence, was founded in 2000, and they're a national clearinghouse for all the other Asian Pacific Islander domestic violence and sexual assault centers. And so they actually have given us some resources to be able for me to do this presentation. They really have a vision of gender democracy, so maybe that's going to challenge you a little bit, thinking about what that means, gender democracy, and to really be culturally specific in thinking about how does violence look differently in API communities versus any other community, versus your mainstream American community. How does domestic violence and sexual assault manifest differently? Okay. So right now I have a breakout question for you, and I only want to do it for a couple minutes, so you really have to get your brain going because we have, I'm looking at the clock. I'm glad I'm sitting here. I'm looking at the clock. Welcome. Come on in. Hello, friends. Huh? All right. Well, you can still listen to this. Breakout question. Can you think of a time when someone told you about a domestic or sexual violence situation that they were facing? What was your response? You don't have to tell the partner that you're talking with who it was, but you can tell them, how did you respond when someone told you this? And if you've never faced this before, where somebody told you about a domestic violence or sexual violence situation, can you imagine if a friend told you about this? What do you think your response would be? And we're not going to take time to do 2 separate breakouts. We'll just do a second question. And so once you answer this question, go to the next question. Now imagine if this person had brought the same conversation to your pastor. So if you're the pastor of the church, you don't have to answer it because it should be the same response as number one. If you're the pastor, you already know how you would respond because you respond to number one. But if you're not the pastor, think about your pastor. And think about how he or she would respond if somebody disclosed to them or shared with them that they were facing domestic violence or had been sexually assaulted. So if it's okay, can you go ahead and just go across the room to somebody that you don't know and go ahead and just share this in the language that you feel more comfortable with? So we'll just do this for about 5 minutes. So at like 1:13, I'm going to ask you guys to come back. And just to let you know, I'm not going to ask you to share it out to the large group. We don't have time for that, and I don't want people to feel uncomfortable with that. So it's just to the person that you're sitting across from. And can you go ahead and just pair up with somebody that you don't know, know if you're here with somebody? I think Iris is part of the thing. She wants to jump in. Okay, just to let you know she's back. Just start wrapping it up in your group, okay? If somebody has not shared yet, please give them a chance to share. Okay, let's come back to the large group and go ahead and just wrap it up. So thank you. I heard some really good sharing in your group. I know we're not going to share out loud to everybody, but is there anything that somebody feels like was really interesting from the conversation that you had that you do want to share? If not, that's okay. We can maybe come to...
You're pointing out, right, that there's a difference when, let's say, a woman comes to a male pastor, maybe would not want to talk about these things with them just because of the gender difference.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting observation.
Okay. And just by show of hands, can I ask you how many of you guys were able to answer the first question with a real scenario of somebody telling you that they were in a domestic violence or sexual violence situation. Can I see a show of hands? Two? Okay. Okay, thank you. So, you know, it's really interesting because I've been doing this job for almost 15 years, and I've done a lot of presentations to churches. And you know, what do you think pastors say to me when I tell them I'm here to do a presentation on domestic violence and sexual assault? What do you think most pastors say? Yeah. Why do you think pastors say that? Nobody told them? Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Anybody else have a guess? Yeah.
You know, ancient, they kept very conservative and they
don't want to speak out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All of those reasons are right on. And, you know, often the answer that I get almost every single time is like, well, we don't really have domestic violence and sexual violence in our congregation. And I've even had pastors tell me before, like, we don't attract that kind of family here. You know, so it's really interesting because if you look at the statistics about domestic violence and sexual assault globally, the World Health Organization, which is a very reputable organization, WHO, has done a study, I believe it was in the early 2000s, globally, of Asian Pacific Islanders throughout the world. So it's not just here in LA, but throughout the world, it's 1 in 2 Asian Pacific Islanders during the course of their lifetime will have experienced either emotional, physical, or sexual violence. And in fact, in the number of people who report the least about it, it's just as you said, Asian Pacific Islanders are the least likely to report, right? There's a lot of cultural things that we'll talk about why they don't report. But if you think about that statistic and apply it here in LA County to the API immigrants who live here, based on the 2010 census, by now it's probably been even more. There's over 1.5 million API. So I'll use that acronym, API, for Asian Pacific Islanders who live here. And of those 1.5 million, over 60% of them are immigrants, and over 40% have limited English. So if you think about just the statistics of how many people in our community statistically will have faced some sort of physical or emotional or sexual violence, that's a lot of people, right? The global statistic is verbal. Mm-hmm. Right, verbal as well. Thank you. Which is also tied to emotional as well. And in fact, you know, I've worked in our shelter programs when I first started at CPAC, and of the women that we talked to, they have told us, by and large, that, you know, the physical violence, I can get over that. That heals. But the verbal and the emotional violence is what stays with them the most for a longer period of time. So for that healing, for verbal and emotional abuse and violence, that actually takes a longer period of time to heal. So why don't Asian Pacific Islanders seek help? These are just some of the reasons, not all of them, and I'll touch upon a couple of them for the interest of time. But for personal reasons, we know that a lot of us might internalize that kind of guilt, like I deserve this, or you know, if someone tells you you deserve that, they internalize it and they blame themselves, like, you know, if I had just done what he told me, or if I had kept the house cleaner, or if I didn't spend the money on this, then he might not have gotten so mad, or he might not have hit me or hurt me. There's also what I said earlier about the limitations of being an immigrant here in the United States. I know San Gabriel Valley is a little bit different because there's a lot more access in terms of language, but if you lived somewhere else, if you lived in the Midwest, for instance, or if you live somewhere else where there wasn't such a large API population, the resources might be a lot fewer. So having no language access is really difficult. There's also cultural reasons. So I know this is just a few of them, but the sense of destiny or fate. So I have a funny story to share. Like, so I come from a Christian family. My dad's like many generations of Christian Taiwanese pastors. And my mom actually is a first generation Christian. She came from a Buddhist family in Taiwan. And so my, you know, grandparents on my mom's side were very devout. They lived near the temple. They were lay leaders or servants in the temple in Taiwan. And so there's a very Buddhist, Taoist kind of mentality around destiny and fate, right? So there's a sense that if you face a challenge or you're suffering over something, you really need to embrace that suffering, right? This is part of your, like, growth or your becoming a better person is actually accepting what you're going through, right? And so it's so funny because, like, even though my mom's been a Christian ever since she's in junior high now, she, like, internalizes some of those messages. So, like, when I was growing up or even in young adulthood, when I was going through something, she would say, don't run away from it. Like, you really need to learn from this, because if you don't learn from this and you try to escape it, you're going to face it again later, you know? And so I don't know how many of us can resonate with that kind of thing, that, like, maybe your parents or the community have told you those types of messages that, like, you really need to just push through it and learn from what you're going through that's very hard, right? So I think in our culture, sometimes those are some messages that we may receive just simply from being in the communities that we're a part of and the cultural values that we hold that we don't even think about, right? There's also gender norms, and I think that comes out as a religious thing. I think Amy told me today a little bit about, like, something earlier in the main session where they were talking about submission to Christ. So I think in some of the gender norms, if we come from a culture in which, and I'll talk about this a little bit more later too, where a male privilege, being a male gives you more access and gives you more privilege, then certainly by virtue of being a woman and being part of a community, a faith community, a Christian community, that says that you just have to submit to your husband even if he's doing something that's being harmful to you or your family, that's a really difficult conversation to navigate, right? Because unless you're on the receiving end of that harm, it's really easy just to tell somebody, well, maybe he's just going through a hard time at his job. Maybe that's something that you just need to, you know, persist and persevere with a lot of prayer. And you just need to be, you know, submit to your husband and things will get better. And let's just pray and hope that God will work through that, right? So we just really kind of need to think about what are some of those barriers for people to then share more, right? If somebody told me that, then I'm just like, maybe I should just go home and pray some more and hopefully things will change. So just kind of thinking about the nuances of the messages that we carry both in our faith as well as in our cultural values. And again, if you have questions, write them down because I'm anticipating them. And then institutional is what I talked about as to why CPAP even started, why an organization like CPAP exists. Because we know that there are people in our communities who don't have access to immigration status. They're maybe here on their husband's visa, and they think, well, I can't leave this situation because if I do, then I'm going to be here illegally. Here, you know, I'm tied to his visa. And so immigration status is something very real. Also finances. I've had people who called me on the hotline before when I talked to them and they said, well, I've never worked in America. So if I were to leave the situation that I'm in, even temporarily, I'm not going to have, you know, I'm not going to be able to take care of myself. And if they have children, they're even more worried because then they say, I can't take care of my children. You know, but CPAP provides for people when they come into our shelter, so that isn't an issue. But certainly in people's understanding, if they've never heard of CPAP, they may be like, well, I can't leave this situation because nobody, my family isn't here, my friends aren't here, I don't have any resources. And I talked about some of these already, reasons why someone stays in an abusive relationship. So we talked about religious beliefs and values. Really, a lot of women that I've talked to before really fear for their children. And they don't leave unless the partner or the husband has actually started harming the children. That's almost the breaking point for a lot of women that we see, is once the husband is harming the children, then they're out of there, right? But for themselves, I've also seen a lot of women come into shelter in their 60s, when they're after 60 years old or even 70. Because their children are all grown up, they're out of the house, they have their own families, and then they can finally leave that relationship, right? Because they fear for their children, like, what will it do to my child if I leave the situation, then my child's going to be stigmatized as having divorced parents. And then how marriageable will they be, right? Can they get married to somebody? Because then they're like, oh, we don't want somebody who came from a broken home, right? Like, there's fear. There's real fear for some women who are afraid to leave abusive situations because they don't want that to impact their children. Right? The other things I've already talked about, finances, children need two parents, feelings of guilt. And then something that I kind of want to talk about, which is a little bit more about the emotion, is that, you know, that there's a statistic that says that most women, and we've seen this in our shelters before, when they first come into our shelter, do you think they all want to stay there? No, a lot of them go back home, right? And that's okay. We don't pressure them to stay. We don't tell them they have to get a divorce. We don't tell them what's good for them, because for a lot of people who are domestic violence survivors, they've already been in a relationship where somebody is always telling them what to do, what to think, how to choose. And so we really believe in empowerment. Like, you make the best decision for yourself. You know what the best decision is. We can give you resources that you never knew about before. We can give you options, but you choose what's best for you. And a lot of people choose to hope that their partner can change, their spouse can change, and that's okay. They go back. So the statistic is that somebody will leave an abusive relationship 8 times. Before they actually leave, right? And so, and I'll tie that to the last bullet point, love for spouse or partner, because in reality, when you first got together with somebody, whether you married them or you got into an intimate relationship, your hope wasn't that this person was going to be abusive, right? Like, you fell in love with somebody that you thought was really great. You know, they treated you well. They spoke kindly to you. Nobody falls in love or nobody gets married to somebody who they hope is going to be abusive to them. Right? So that, as an organization, we just really want to be mindful of where people are. Like, what they really hope that this person is going to love them and be who they thought they were. I'm going to touch upon the second to last bullet point, the cultural and societal norms of acceptance of violence against women and girls in a later slide, so I'm going to skip forward. So how many of you have seen the domestic violence power and control wheel, just by a show of hands? Okay. So a lot of times when I go into the community and I talk about domestic violence, what do you think people first think about? Like, what is domestic violence? Like when somebody hits somebody, right? They think a domestic violence looks like a black eye, right? But what we really want to do is help the community understand that domestic violence is more than just physical. And I talked about that earlier a little bit in the previous point about emotional, verbal, sexual. And so this is like a domestic violence, we call it the domestic violence power and control rule, because really at the heart of domestic violence isn't an argument. Me and my husband have been married over 15 years. We've argued a lot. But an argument or being in conflict is not domestic violence, right? Domestic violence at its heart or at its root is about power and control. And that's where one person over a course of time consistently tries to control the other person or have power over them. And how do they do that? They do it through a number of ways. It's not just hitting, right? It's not just physical. But it can be emotional abuse. We talked about putting somebody down, making them feel bad about themselves, humiliating them, making them feel guilty. Using isolation is another way. So, you know, I've talked to a woman before from Taiwan on our hotline, and she eventually came into our shelter, who the husband, she lived with her in-laws here in America. So her husband controlled what she did. He's like, you can't go outside of the house. They just had a 1-year-old baby. So he said, you have to stay home with baby all the time. The baby needs you. You can't go out. And when he would go to work, he would ask his parents, who is another form of, like, controlling her, to tell her she can't go out, right? And if she wants to go out, they let her go once a week to a church, like, fellowship. The baby had to stay with the grandparents, right? So using isolation to make sure that she doesn't have a lot of connections is another way to control someone, right? Sexual is a really big one. So, and I don't know how people feel about this, because we've had focus group before with the women in our shelter around their views of sex. And, you know, I know it's hard to talk about in the church community. I'm going to just talk about it because I'm limited on time. So sexual violence is one of those ways in which in America, marital rape exists. You can be in a marriage relationship and still be raped, right? Because no means no. If you don't want to have sex with somebody, you don't have to, even though you're married to them. But we had a focus group in our shelter of all immigrant API women, and we were asking them what their ideas are. And they were like, marital rape? What's that? You know, like, they're like, if you're married, if your husband wants to have sex, you just have sex with them. That's part of being married. So, you know, I think we really need to think about how that, this is exactly where I'm talking about the cultural differences, right, of our perception of what our expectations are of sex in an intimate partner relationship. If you're a woman and you want to have sex, that's great. But if you don't want to have sex, are you obligated to because you're married to someone? So the thing is that in intimate partner relationships, sexual violence is the hardest to see, right? Because you can see a black eye. But if your husband's forcing you to have sex, which we have all sorts of women in our shelter who, Christian or not, they may have had just a baby for 3 months, and I'm talking about somebody we helped about 4 years ago. After 3 months, her husband's like, all right, let's do it. And he's like, she's like, I just had a baby. I'm still nursing my baby. I'm not going to have sex. And he, you know, he would harass her about that. So sexual violence is something that you can't see because when it happens, guess what? I'm wearing clothes. You can't see it, right? Nobody walks around naked. So this is one of the most insidious, most, like, harmful things that you can do to somebody because you can't, nobody knows that's happening unless you tell them. And because sex is such a taboo topic, especially in the Christian community, that gets really hard to talk to. If you're a pastor, if you're a cell group leader, if the deacon in your church, nobody seems to be open to talking about this kind of stuff, then this is the stuff that gets really buried for a long, long time. Using children, and I'm going to go through the rest of it really quick because there's so many other slides. So using children is like making her feel guilty about like you're a bad mom, and sometimes they use the children to tell the mom messages, like, but I kind of do that too. Like, I tell my kids to tell my husband to go exercise more, so, but I don't try to have power and control over my husband. But, you know, like children, in-laws, so we can see how extended family can sometimes be used to continue to perpetuate the power and control over somebody, okay? And this I'm just going to go over really briefly because this is like what I call the mainstream or American model of what domestic violence looks like. So in a domestic violence situation, there's a tension building where the person who's being controlled knows that something's going to happen. Like at some point there's going to be a blow up, some sort of incident that either she gets harmed or he throws something, and it's just a big explosive incident that will eventually happen. And then after that, there's a calm honeymoon phase where he feels really sorry, and he says, I'm really sorry, this won't happen again, I'm going to try to change. Some people will be like, I'll go to counseling. This is, gives her gifts, takes her out for a nice dinner. And what we found in working with the Asian community is this happens, but you know what's missing? This. You know why? Because this is very much like you see it in the movies or TV shows kind of thing. But for API immigrant women, and I just to let you know, not all survivors or people who are being harmed are women. They're also men. But the vast majority, the statistics tell us that it's over 90% who are women. So because of statistics, I'll use women. This is missing because API immigrant women who are on their husband's visa, or they don't know anybody here, they don't have the luxury of just walking away from the relationship, right? Like, they don't know anybody. They don't have any money. Where are they going to go get help? Where are they going to stay? So if anything, what we've seen mostly is that women who are abused by their husbands and there's a big incident, guess what happens? They kick them out the door, right? And they're like, close the door. And the woman's on the outside of the door, banging on the door, asking, can I please come back in? Even though she's just been abused, right? Or she's just been really harmed. Because the person who is trying to maintain power and control knows that he has the power, right? He goes, I'm the one here with the visa. Like, you don't have anything. You're nothing without me. So unfortunately, in the cycle of domestic violence, API immigrant women, very few of them have the luxury of having a honeymoon phase where their husband is like, oh, come back to me. I'm sorry. I'll change. If anything, they're being kicked out of the house. They're being further harmed and saying, well, you know, see what you're going to do. You might get deported. You know, good luck. Go back home. You know, and then they have to beg, like, you know, can I just come back home? Can I come back in? Sexual assault. and I'm sorry, I'm going really fast. I want to make sure there's time for Q&A. Sexual assault, so I said earlier that sexual assault is one of the parts, or sexual violence is part of domestic violence as well sometimes, is any kind of sexual activity that's not consensual. And the state of California has one of the most broad definitions of sexual assault. It's not just penetration. I'm going to talk very candidly in the interest of time. So some people think rape is sexual assault only. It is a form of sexual assault, but there's a lot of other forms of sexual assault. So when you guys were talking earlier for your breakout question, remember I asked you, did anybody ever tell you about domestic or sexual violence and how did you respond? Well, maybe you were thinking just about rape, right? But what about all of the other forms of sexual violence? So they can include sexual harassment, right? Somebody doesn't actually just have to rape you for it to be considered sexual assault. It can be somebody who's touching you inappropriately. It can be somebody who's making obscene phone calls. It can be someone who's stalking you. It can be voyeurism. It can be fondling, molestation. You know, I'll share one of mine just because I want to just put it out there that sexual assault isn't just rape. And this didn't, you know, this is part of our training. When you first come to CPAS, all of our staff have to go through a 65-hour training on domestic violence and sexual assault. And then when we were going through the sexual assault portion, I was like, well, I'm a sexual assault survivor then. And I didn't realize it because when I was in seventh grade, and I lived here in San Gabriel Valley, I remember I was walking home from school in junior high to my grandparents' house, and I was walking by myself, and all of a sudden there's a car that pulled up next to me, right? And I was like, oh, who's that? And I didn't know. It was a complete stranger in the car. And it kept following me, and I kind of got nervous, and I looked over, and the man was masturbating. So he had his pants off, he was masturbating, and he just kept staring at me. And I've never seen a naked man's body before, so I didn't know exactly what he was doing, but I knew that I felt really awful and, like, scared. So I ended up just walking faster and then totally running to my grandparents' house, like running the rest of the way. And I felt like I didn't even know what that was, right? As a 12-year-old, I had no idea what that man was doing, but I knew it felt icky and it felt, like, weird. And I never told anybody about it. Like, I never told my parents about it. I have two sisters that I'm very close with, and I never told anybody about it. But that is, like, if you think very broadly about the context in which we live in, sexual assault and sexual violence is so prevalent. And, you know, you can say, well, what's the big deal? Like, somebody can tell me, what's the big deal? Nothing happened to you. Like, you were fine, right? And what we need to think about when we're thinking about gender equity and gender privilege, which is really a deeper issue here, is that how do our girls feel? How are our girls growing up in a community where they feel valued and respected? Because actually, I have to say, I grew up kind of feeling scared about being a girl. And, you know, my husband is a 6-foot white, 6'4" white, you know, white American person. And, you know, when I came home from the training, I realized when I leave the shopping center, if I go to Ralph's or if I go to 99 Ranch and it's nighttime, when I'm walking to my car, I actually kind of feel scared. Like, I have to, like, look around. I mean, I don't know if the women in the room feel the same way, but I'm, like, walking fast to my car. I'm trying to get in, close the door, unlock my doors, go home. And I asked my husband, have you ever felt that way? And he goes, no. You know, which is like, that was such a mind-blowing moment for me. I'm like, and so in our 65-hour training, we've asked that question regularly. It's like, how many men feel that way? Or how many people feel that way? Like, if you're walking by yourself, especially at night, how many of you actually kind of feel scared for your own safety? All the women, girls' hands go up. And mostly none of the men raise their hands, right? So this is something that I just want us to think about, because if you're a man, you actually have a lot of privilege. You have a lot of privilege of feeling like you're not going to be sexually assaulted, right? But women walk around with that a lot. I would say most women feel that way. And so if you can imagine, even just for my experience walking home at 12 years old, like for me, even though nothing happened, it felt like the potential of that could happen, right? So I just want us to, I want to call a little bit of attention to that. And one thing I want to say is that at CPAC, when we take the hotline call, somebody is calling because at some point there was an incident that occurred, right? Some sort of precipitating incident that led that individual to call. Might have been the husband finally hit the kids. It might be he took her, this happens before too, she was a working professional, he took her work computer with all her work on it and smashed it. That he didn't hurt her, but he just totally destroyed her property. That's domestic violence, right? So we ask what happened. But really, when we're talking about API women, when we're talking about Chinese, Taiwanese, Malaysian, Indonesian, when we're talking about API women, what we really need to think about is the lifetime spiral of violence. Okay? So this is developed by, earlier I introduced the organization API-GBV. They're the National Resource Center for all the API organizations working on domestic violence, sexual assault throughout the whole country. And they did, this is based on a study that they did in the South Asian community. And this really opened up my eyes. This really changed the way that I saw looking at domestic violence and sexual assault. Because the question no longer is, why did you call me today? Or what happened last week? Or what happened today? Because when we talk about domestic violence and sexual violence as a point in time, do you know what I mean by point in time? Like one thing that happened that day that led you to call or actually reach out for help. That's actually a partial way. It's just an incomplete way of looking at the whole situation. So when you look at a woman, and I'm using woman because this is when we're starting to talk about gender privilege and gender bias, is that when you look at a person's lifetime, women and girls are far more vulnerable to the kind of violence that they can experience from a number of different ways. It wasn't until, was it the 1990s, where the one-child law in China was changed? Can someone correct me? Because I might be getting that wrong. I've looked it up, but I can't remember the year that it was changed.
Yeah, I think after 1990,
yeah. Okay. After 2000. So prior to that, not just in China, but in other countries where maybe there is not as many resources, there's a bias, right, to want to have male children, right, for very practical reasons, not just because they hate girls, right, it's not that, it's because, maybe they're in an agrarian culture where they have a farm, and they need boys to work in the farm, so they don't want to have a girl, so there's sex-selected abortion, right, so it's like, if you have the technology to find out if you're having a boy or a girl, then you can abort your girls. Right? That's why we know that in China there's villages in which they're just primarily boys, right, men, because they all sex-selected, aborted their girls, right? So when you, so I'll go through this really quickly. For children, so the first year that my husband and I were married, I got a fellowship from Fuller Seminary to live abroad for a year it was a preaching scholarship, basically. So I was able to go abroad to do more cross-cultural preaching and also take more classes to enhance that. And part of our time, we were in Uganda. Now, Uganda is one of those countries that doesn't have state-sponsored education. A lot of countries don't. So if you want to enroll your kids in school, you have to pay for them. Well, who do you think gets to go to school? Boys, right? Why don't they want to educate the girls? Well, sort of. That would be true if they weren't all running around on the streets, right? So so we worked with a lot of the street girls in Uganda, and they weren't allowed, it was just a gender privilege, right? They were thinking, well, we want to invest in our boys, right? We want them to go off to college, or we want them to have a good education, and they'll do something great for our family, right? And our girls can just hopefully marry somebody. Hopefully marry somebody who's smart and will take care of them, right? So we know with the girls, there was a lot of street girls. And if you know a lot about Uganda, there's the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA there, who is very well known for kidnapping a lot of girls and taking them to be sex slaves for the Lord's Resistance Army. Right? So they're like an enemy of the state in a way. But they're not trafficking the boys. Right? They're trafficking the girls. And why are they trafficking the girls? Well, the girls are just out on the street. I mean, they're literally just out on the street playing all day and, you know, maybe some of them are helping, but there's so much potential for them to become child prostitutes or kidnapped, become LRA sex slaves. That's just an example. But as teenagers, again, there's a, you know, this is a time when girls are just learning about sex and sexuality, and there's a lot of potential for girls from teenagers to young adulthood to experience some sort of sexual violence. In fact, the statistics tell us that in the United States, when they're looking at all the women who have experienced some sort of sexual assault, the age range in which they have the most people who have been sexually assaulted year after year is between ages 18 to 25. So when you look at the number of reported sexual assaults, the highest number of age range, and the highest number, the age range with the highest number of people is 18 to 25. So this is the time when girls are going to college, right? They're probably kind of just learning about their own sexuality. And that is also the time when they need exploring and not knowing what their boundaries are and what their limits are or how to say no or anybody who has told them that it's okay to say no. Right? So just as a little plug there, Jackie and I are in this parenting training together, but it's why I tell my girls, I have two girls at home, that when Uncle Mama come over, my parents come over, I don't make them give them a hug. I don't make them kiss them, right? My dad, he's a great guy, but he's so old school. He's like, like the Uncle Jin today, like, you know, it's like, come give Uncle a kiss. And I have to repeatedly, like, Dad, don't be mad, don't be offended. Just if they want to, they will, and can you ask? So it's really teaching our boys that you need to ask, right? You need to ask. It's like you, Daddy, I tell my dad, Daddy, you can say, Ako, oh, do you want to give Ako a kiss? That's okay, but don't say, like, Ako's in today. You know, like, oh, he's, you know, it's kind of funny. He's like, come on, give Ako a hug. I will buy you something. I'm like, oh, my God. No, don't say that, Dad. You know, because when those messages are given at such an early age, think about how girls are understanding what love or what a positive intimate relationship looks like when they're older, right? Like, how are those messages being translated? So it's really different because, like, I don't know if it's the same for boys. Like, please think about that. It's just a question that I'm asking. It's like, I don't know if it's the same for boys. And then, of course, into adulthood and then elderly is a lot of just the potential when you've grown up with that kind of mentality for you to be more vulnerable to domestic violence and sexual violence, right? Yeah, these are just close-ups of each of them, and Amy said that they would post them later. So if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'll give you my contact information at the end. What does the scripture say about domestic and sexual violence? There's nothing that's that explicit. There's the rape of Tamar in the Old Testament, but aside from that, there isn't very explicit instruction around domestic and sexual violence. But when you look through the prophets, What is God most grieved about with his people? He's sad that they've turned away from him. But he also says to remove the evil that you've been doing. And he says, cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. And I think when you read through the prophets, especially in Hosea, in Amos, you see that God is always wanting to defend those who are powerless. Those who have less power than those who have, right? He looks at the orphan. He looks at the oppressed. He looks at the widows. Those who don't have position, those who don't have power, God is standing with them. And so when we think about that in a domestic violence or sexual violence situation, let's think about, you know, it might be easy to go to scriptures like Ephesians 5 and say you just need to submit. But let's also think about the balanced message that we should be giving to people when we think about what the heart of God is like. Is he just wanting to retain some sort of patriarchal structure within our communities and within our churches? Or is he really wanting to stand with people who have been harmed and don't have a lot of power? In Psalms 11:5, the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and his soul hates the lover of violence. Okay, so there is some indication that God does not approve of violence. But how has scripture been used to support domestic and sexual violence? So this is what I referred to earlier in Ephesians 5. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, be subject to your husband as you are to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, just as Christ is the head of the church, the body of which he is the Savior. Just as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be in everything to their husbands. So how many people have heard this being used before to kind of promote a complementarian structure in relationships? I've heard it a lot, actually, but not from my husband, but from a lot of church communities, right? And I think that if you are a pastor, or if you've been in seminary, you know that this is one of the most problematic passages for people who argue for an egalitarian relationship in which men and women are viewed at equally, right? It's very problematic. So I had to take my Bible content exam. I'm going through ordination right now with PCUSA, Presbyterian Church USA, and I had to go back to one of my old textbooks from Raymond Brown. He's a really well-known theologian who wrote this really thick, like, 900-page introduction to the New Testament that I tried to read all of it to pass my Bible content exam. But he talks about this, and it's really good for me to review this because he says this. Ephesians 21, which is this section, begins with an instruction to be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. And, of course, that affects husbands to wives as well as wives to husbands. The obligation of the husband to love is treated more extensively than the obligation of the wife to be subject, and both are rooted in God's initial plan for union and marriage. The radical thrust of the gospel is putting pressure on those who have the authority and power. Okay. So if you think about what Raymond Brown is saying, he is actually pulling back a little bit from just looking at that passage to looking at the context in which Paul is writing to the Ephesians, the church of Ephesus. And he's saying this, you know, in Ephesians and back in those times, it is a male-dominated society. Men do have privilege over women, right? And if you told a woman you have to submit to your husband, she would be like, of course I do. There would be no argument about that. It's not 2019 in America. This is the early church in 1 AD. So when he's telling this to women, women are like, of course we do. Right? It's no big deal. So who is the challenge to? Yeah, this is a very countercultural message for men. Because he's saying, the very first verse in 21 says, be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. He's saying, men, you have to be subject to women, and women, husbands, you need to be subject to wives, and wives have to be subject to their husbands. That's radical. Right? That's something that if you were a man in 1 AD listening to Paul speak, you'd be like, what? Right? Because he is saying you have to love your wife just as Christ loves the church. And that's a lot of pressure. I'm glad I'm not a man. That's a lot of pressure to have to love your wife as Christ loves the church. So Raymond Burrow ends that section on the last sentence, which I really like, is that it's the radical thrust of the gospel. And you'll see this in all the other, you know, when he writes in Philemon, you know, when his slave Onesimus runs away, Paul tells Philemon, he's this rich person, Onesimus is your slave, but I want him to be able to come back to you because he's useful to me. And I want you to embrace him like a brother. In a society where there are slaves and there are owners, what do you mean, embrace my slave like a brother? So this is not just an isolated passage that I'm picking up. Paul is actually radically challenging power structures and power authorities and those who have the power to use it in a way that reflects the way that God loves the church. So when you have a brother who comes to you in your church, or you have a sister who comes to you in church and tells you that the husband is, like, abusing her, the challenge to you first is to think about who has the power and what is the gospel saying about those who have power. So, you know, I'm not going to do another breakout because we're running out of time and I want to give time for Q&A because Amy, like, Iris is coming up. Just think about this presentation. Take this question home with you and think about it.
what might be different ways that your church responds to disclosures telling you about domestic and sexual violence? What might be different ways that your church responds to disclosures about domestic and sexual violence? What additional support or resources do you think you need or your church needs to better support survivors of domestic and sexual violence? Because if the global statistics are there are 1 in 2 women, then here in LA County, within that 1.5 million people who are API immigrants, there's a good number. I think there's a good number. If you want to contact me, you're free to. One thing that I would like to say is that I am doing a training right now with faith communities with so I'm partnering with my mother. If you don't know my mother, she works for Family Keepers. She volunteers. She's one of the volunteer directors for Family Keepers. So she will be doing presentations for churches with me on how to respond for church staff and leaders. It could be lay leaders on how to respond to domestic violence and sexual assault. And putting in some concrete protocols and procedures for how to do that. Because we can talk about it all day long, but when it actually happens, like, what do? Did you call the police? You know, how do you sit down with a husband and wife? So we're going to talk about, like, what are some really practical things your church could do? And she will be translating that for me in either Mandarin or Taiwanese, your choice. Sorry, she doesn't speak Cantonese. But if you're interested in that, please let me know. And if there was a sign-up sheet going around, if you haven't signed in, please sign in. And then I can, if you're interested, I can send you more information about that. It's a 2-day training. We provide lunch. Yeah, so if your church is interested in that, take it back to your church and ask them if they'd be interested. And there's my email up there, ellen.hong@cpath.info if you'd like to get in touch with me. And, of course, our hotline number for CPath. Okay. There's about 6 minutes left for Q&A. Oh, Jackie, you asked that. You always have the hardest questions. Yes, Jackie.
my kid's grandma, my mom's living in the house now. So as you said, my uncle cannot stay in there. Come here, kids are not there. At what age the kids can say no to parents and grandparents?
So that is a really difficult question because I think...
I think I'm in domestic violence when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where you're going.
If you don't do the homework, you have to go to dinner. Okay, but I do it, right? So to that end, right, to the American culture, right, that's a power over me, right? Okay, right?
Yeah.
If I don't do my homework, something like that, yeah.
Well, as you know, Jackie, it's a very hard question because I think there's a lot of cultural, so I'll speak to the cultural expectations. The cultural expectations is that you respect your elder. It doesn't matter what they've done. It doesn't matter if they're like a mafia head or they're whatever, like they've killed someone. It doesn't matter. You respect your elders, right? That's a given. And so I think that when we talk about children and elders, it's really hard to talk about, but we have to think about, we have to also think about that there is a power structure, right? And Jackie and I are in a training where we both feel very challenged as parents because, you know, like, I want to make my kids do things, but, you know, how do I do it in a way that gives them a sense of ability to say yes or no and make good decisions for themselves, right? So I'm always, like, as a parent, I'm always trying to navigate that because I want, especially because I have girls, I want them to feel empowered when they're growing up to make good decisions for themselves. Yeah? Yeah.
所以好像也不会跟个案说，有人在公司里面，然后呢，老板说，哦，这个东西太重了，你们女生，不用女生男生来搬，结果就被告说这是sexual discrimination，是有这种女的。So yeah, not in church, but in the company. So, so the boss says, this heavy thing, you girls don't do it. So we have a boy to lift it up.
Mm-hmm.
Is that considered sexual discrimination?
For discrimination? I don't know. I mean, I think that when they're, I mean, as you know, women get paid 70 cents on the dollar, right? So that what I mean by that is that the gender equity is an issue in the workplace. I don't know about lifting heavy things, but definitely for the same job a man can do, a woman only gets paid, for every dollar he gets, she gets 70 cents, right? So there's gender bias already there in the workplace, even in 2019 America. So if women are getting passed up for jobs that
pay more or have more responsibility because the boss thinks that the woman can't do it, then yeah, there is some discrimination there.
No, there's difference. That's mm-hmm. like the benefit of the lady, the boss don't want to hurt the lady because men seem stronger. Just lady first. I think lady first is also a discrimination. Why lady should be first? But it's the same thing, right? So that's the way how they treat ladies, right? If it's too heavy, right? Maybe let men do it. Right? I think your point is that, right?
So maybe, so that's again a man making a decision for a woman. I think it would be different if he asked the female employee, would you want to do this? And she said no, then he can go find somebody else to do it. Right? So that's just a different, like, that's somebody using their decision-making for someone else rather than asking them.
Right? Yeah. How can the corporation run without this orderly commander chain? Right? I let it do everything, so why should I be a man?
Are there other questions? I know we're running out of time. There's just one or two. Maybe more related specifically to domestic or sexual violence, because I want us to use the time to really explore this as much as we can. Divorce, if they want to. I mean, if they want to, but we never say you have to, because even with divorce, there's, I mean, if I look at scripture, Jesus says, you know, I only did it because your heart, he says about Moses, your hearts were hard. And he says that in the Gospels, I only permitted divorce because your hearts were hard. But is that the hope that we want all these families to be divorced and separated? Absolutely not, because what happens to our communities? They're really broken and they're really fragmented. And kids grow up with one parent, it's not easy. That's not easy. And when we see kids who have to bounce back and forth between homes because of visitations, go to weekend on dad's, Monday through Friday with mom, that's not easy. You know, it's hard for the kids. So we don't recommend anything. We just provide the option, and if that's what they want to do, then we...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that they have to explore on their own, right? Yeah. It's not.
I think as Christians, I think we should not provide the divorce. Unless it is the other person that spouse who commit the sexual immorality.
So I think you can look at that one verse, but I think if you look at the whole of Scripture, right? I think we all have to think about, is it God's intention for people to be in situations that they're harmed repeatedly, right? I'm not talking about a fight. Like, I'm not talking about argument, because we all, if you're in an intimate partner relationship, I don't think any relationship is perfect. We all have fights. We all have arguments. But if somebody is repeatedly being harmed in a situation where there's consistent power and control over them, then we need to think about that, right? We need to think about what is God's best for each person. So then I would say this. If you're a pastor, my greatest challenge for you isn't, well, help her get a divorce. Because most pastors, you know what they say to me? They say, it's like, I'm not just the pastor for the woman. I'm the pastor for the whole family. And I would say, yeah, you are. So you know what that means? As a pastor or as a leader of a church, your responsibility is to hold that person accountable. Right? Your responsibility in the family of God, then, for that family, if you're that family's whole pastor, that whole family's pastor, your responsibility is to hold that person accountable. I worked with the church for over 10 years in the South Bay. And, you know, they're just an amazing supportive. They're a huge church, probably like 700 people. And through my ongoing relationship with them over the last 10 years, you know what happened? So somebody I knew was in a small group. They didn't tell the pastor, but that person told another small group member that her husband was physically harming her and the children. So they called me, and I gave them some, you know, options. And we didn't hear from them for a long time. And then I found out later that the church sent some men to their house and confronted the husband. Do you know how radical that is? because most Asians will say, that's not my problem. I don't want to get involved in their family thing. Church is church, family is family. And I don't want to get involved. That's between them two. They need to work it out. But I would challenge people who have the authority and the power in a church structure to say, it is your responsibility. If you're saying no divorce, then you go down there and you tell him, as a fellow brother, that in the love with the love of God, cut it out. Stop it. That's not acceptable here in our faith community. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it varies from church to church. I think some churches might be more open to that. And I just want to honor Iris's time because Iris is going to...
We tell them how to come back to the school. No, double.
Yeah.
No touching. Otherwise, I will take away the use of domestic violence. Also.
Huh?
It's also considered an act of violence.
That, I think, so that's something that Jackie and I, that's like a 10-day training that Jackie and I are doing around parenting. And I think it'd be great because actually our hope is that Jackie will be one of the parent educators in the future that talk about how to parent with a lot of emotional resilience, which is a whole different thing from domestic violence and sexual assault. I think what you're talking about is limits and boundaries. And in my opinion, it's absolutely okay to a parent with limit and boundaries. I dropped off my girls at my sister's house. I said, no playing basketball until you finish your homework and violin. That's my limit and boundary. That
is
not
considered domestic violence.
No, that's not domestic violence. Yeah. Yeah, but you have a hotline number. Make sure you write that down. Is there a last question? I'll take one last question, and then if not, feel free to stay in touch. I'm sorry I didn't bring the flyer for the trainings with me, but if you're interested in a 2-day training for your church and your church staff, and just to let you know, if you've been aware in the news, there have been, you know, some people think, oh, it's not in Asian churches, it's not in Chinese churches. There have been sexual assault cases that have come out, really big ones, in Chinese churches in San Gabriel Valley recently. And if you know about that, you know that it's really hard. Like, churches are really affected by that when that comes out. So if you have any desire to build some resources, the training is absolutely free. We provide lunch. Then please contact me. Please email me. And yeah, it'll be a 2-day training, though. So it's, each day is about anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, depending on what time you have. But it's for the church pastors, deacons, elders, and any small group leaders, because we know sometimes... when I was in seminary, my systematic theology professor told me this. Once a year, in the pulpit, in your sermon, mention sexual assault. You know why? Because then your congregation knows that you are comfortable talking about that. If you never talk about it, then they will assume you are not comfortable. You're scared to talk about that topic. Right? Once a year, talk about it. It has to be 2 separate. Like, we prefer one month and then another month because there's homework in between. Come on, man, we're done. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Oh, I think Amy's gonna post the PDF.
Yeah. ABC.